See, there's the red flashy light. Do you see it?
Yes.
See, that means it's now it's recording. All that time that we were talking before, no, that was warm up. That was getting us going there. So we're at Del Artemis Farm. Last night we recorded a podcast, and now this morning we're recording another one. And we got to be on the road here in a little bit. And then last night. I went to bed, and then Ivan decided to stay up. This morning I woke up, and Ivan has extra enthusiasm and a list. So Ivan, how long were you up past me?
I don't know. It was some hours, and it was awesome with Marina and Robert. We were talking and drinking wine, and it's a lot of awesome stuff going on here. And what we were talking about the challenges and stuff on the farm was so interesting that it would be nice to try to reproduce it for the big podcast audience.
Okay, so now you've listened to most of my podcasts, so these must be things that are not yet covered in the existing podcast gob. So new topics, new stuff to talk about, and I know that one of the items on the list we just added this morning, and this has to do with cleaning. And we had a podcast a little while ago about eco-cleaning stuff. And so I heard something, and I thought, ooh, that's a new one on me. We should add that in real quick-like. And so, the pigs are going by. There's free-range pigs. They're able to come and poop on your porch if they want to, but they seem to be polite that way.
They're not in the yard.
They choose to really not poop where you're going. They seem to be kind of considerate about where they put their poop. I know I was looking for it because there's a lot of them. How many pigs you got loose here?
20.
All right. And I think the last time we were here there were two. And so... lots of pigs and piglets all over the place, and they could walk up and chew on your toes if they wanted to, but they seem to be more interested in other things. But all right, so cleaning. I thought an interesting point came up this morning with cleaning, and so Marina, you were saying something about how you did some cleaning at one point with vinegar.
Yes.
And you found that cleaning with vinegar sucked.
It just didn't. Things would tend, the inside of a nasty fridge would continue to smell slightly nasty and vinegary after I cleaned it.
All right, so just the nasty plus vinegar, as opposed to like the smell of like nothing, which is a sign of clean. So you're kind of like rubbing the gross stuff around, and now it's and enhancing it a bit. You're like mixing a different kind of goo in with. All right, so what do you find does work? What do you find does clean it up?
Just as an experiment one day, I had this really strong, sour, vinegary kombucha, and I was like, oh, I wonder if I should try using this instead, because I don't have to, I have to buy apple cider vinegar right now, and I make kombucha, so it's something I constantly kind of have a lot of, and when it gets too sour, I don't want to drink it. So one day I was like, what if I clean out my nasty fridge and use kombucha instead of vinegar? And, so I tried that, and I was amazed because afterwards my fridge that had smelled like rotten blood didn't smell like anything. It didn't smell vinegary, it didn't smell like kombucha, and it definitely didn't smell like rotten blood anymore. So I thought that was really cool, and that's what I use now.
It got the job done. Mm-hmm. All right. I like that idea because everybody's so bonkers about kombucha, and I don't understand it. It's like they took perfectly good tea. Isn't it tea that they start off with, and then they make it damn nasty. So maybe you're getting microbials in there to do some of that work for you. So, all right. Anything else about cleaning stuff, cleaning tips? Of course, you didn't get to hear our podcast about cleaning. Mm-hmm. I know that you've got cast iron here that's awesome. And we talked a little bit about the soap making part of the podcast. Don't, because I don't like lye. Do you guys keep any lye around? No. Okay.
You need some lye in order to make lutefisk. How would you make a lutefisk without lye?
You don't.
Yeah, I think so far in my life I've gotten by without any lutefisk.
Also, preserving olives. They're usually soaked in a lye solution first.
Okay, and now I've decided I'm not eating olives anymore. anything else I should avoid because it has lye in it? I mean, it's like we could probably get some sort of industrial toxic waste, and you could try making lutefisk out of that. I mean, maybe you'll come up with a whole new kind of lutefisk. And then the idea is that, you know, you could prove your Norwegian prowess by, like, look, I took this toxic waste and fish mixed together, and I ate it, and I'm alive to tell about it. However, Bjorn over there, he's down for the count. Something like that. Turns out he's a wuss.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That's because I kind of figured that's how lutefisk is that.
Well, it's like gelé fish. No, that's
gelatinous fish.
Yeah.
It's fish in a more gelatinous state.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
that's the English word.
Have you heard of gelatin?
Yes.
Look, I made fish jello.
Yeah.
It's an idea. I've just thrown it out there for you. Less toxic gick.
Sure, thanks.
Yeah.
I'll bring it back to Norway.
Tell Norway, when you get back there, tell them, you know, that I gave them this idea. It's just a thought. Yeah, maybe more of them will live longer or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Paul Wheaton said lutefisk improvement, like the woofarte and all the other stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have to come up with a whole new word, so that way, you know, they won't get confused with the stuff with the lie in it.
Yeah.
All right. And then this morning, there was some discussion about hops. So for myself, I know that it's a pretty popular one to use on the south side of a greenhouse because a greenhouse will oftentimes get way too hot in the summertime. And so a lot of people will plant hops along the south side, and it grows crazy fast, usually like 10 to 15 feet, and then cover that south side and so it can stay a little cooler. And so you've got some hops here.
On the south side of the giant window in the front of my tiny cabin for shade.
Okay, and how fast does it grow for you?
I just started off with a couple of little rhizomes from my friend Asiya, and the first year they only got like 5 feet tall or something. The second year they came up in like early April and were 5 feet tall in a month, and then this year, yeah, they're kind of covering half the side of the wall over there.
So, and then every year they pop back up and covered up. And so then in the wintertime, when you want the sun to come in, then they're gone. They're
mm-hmm.
all done. Mm-hmm. And then every summer, like in the early summer when it's still kind of cool out, they're not so big. But then by the time the really hot season rolls around, they're big and covering up the window really well. Okay. So, and then you mentioned Afia. Afia, she was up at the sepulcher thing, and so when I got sick, she's a naturopath, and she came and brought me stuff to try and make me less sick. So, and she's also the one who's got that women's only thing, like she asked me to help promote it, and I was like, that seems weird to me. so there apparently here in the Northwest, there's going to be I think in Ashland, there's going to be some sort of women's only event. For permaculture, which kind of, to me, it really bothers me. But, well, you're going to tell me how it goes, right? Like, was it good? Like, did it somehow, like, women only? Because to me, it sounds like saying, oh, white people only. Only white people are allowed. If you're black, you don't get to go. And in this case, if you're male, you don't get to go. And it's like, really? So anyway, I'm kind of feeling like, I don't know, as part of the whole social justice package of permaculture, shouldn't we kind of like be saying sexism is bad, but it seems like we're promoting it. Obviously, I must require greater education, like I must be stupid or something. So
you might have a point there, Paul, but there is also a point to separating when you look at the group dynamic. The group dynamic tends to be different if they're are women only or some men?
True, and I'm sure the group dynamic is different too if you say only white people or if you say, I don't know, what are some other ist things? No gay people allowed. Gay people are not allowed, and then we'll have a different dynamic. It'll be a different group dynamic. And then, you know, or we could start dividing based on whatever other little, you know, physical attribute we want. People with blonde hair are not allowed. No blonde-haired people allowed. And then, yeah, you'll have a different dynamic. I think it's true that there's a lot. I mean, if it's women only, that there will be, like, I don't know, something a little bit different. But I kind of feel like it still strikes me as odd and inappropriate. I mean, if we had a men's only event 20 years ago, I think feminists would be very like, well, we're gonna have a permaculture event, but only men are allowed. Women are not allowed. Only men. I think we'd have a lot of feminists up in arms over that, like the old boy network, you know. And I think rightly so. I think we've come a long ways to correct that, and now I'm a little concerned we've overshot. But obviously, I must be nuts. Let's talk about things that are more interesting. Things that are on the list that you brought up last night. So what are pick one off of your list here.
Well, what was cool about the stuff we were talking about yesterday was that it was the nitty gritty stuff about the different techniques that we learn about, and I don't know, it must have been the wine or something else, but all the details I can't remember. you pick one, Marina.
What's on the list?
Well, we've talked a little bit about how this has been a particularly kind of challenging year, in that there's been several things that haven't gone to plan, shall we say. And Robert and I had this things kind of, when he told me that the solar hot water heating panel broke one morning, I just, it was kind of like the accumulative stress of all of those things kind of came out in one big wah session. And I was feeling really down about it. We both were, about how we're not actually doing what we want here. But then in the middle of that conversation, I had this realization that none of the setbacks make me want to sell everything and move back to town.
I mean, I would imagine that how you feel on this piece of land with what you've done right now is probably like way, way, way ahead of anything within 50 miles of here. I mean, do you think that there's a piece of property within 50 miles of your land where they're like doing what you want to do better than you?
I think that's definitely a possibility.
Possibility.
But I haven't seen it. Yeah, I don't know. People seem to want to talk about how great permaculture is and staying home and growing food and stuff, but then the actual day-to-day time that's required, you know, you can't just leave for a week if you want to.
If you have animals.
Yeah. Well, most of the time if you have a garden, too, unless you can have somebody come along. And.
So now part of what I advocate is the idea that there'll be 20 people living under one roof. And that, you know, and you're sharing the land. And then if you want to leave for 2 weeks, well, there's 18 other people. So, like, if you and Robert want to head out and go see some family or something like that, there's 18 other people, and hopefully at least six of them have some idea of how to raise the animals and work with them. I just think that when you have, with many hands, there's light work. And I kind of think also that there's ways that you could set up paddock shift systems, which you're not doing with the pigs, but which would make.
Well, shall we talk about fencing?
We can talk about fencing. I mean,
like,
I've got
yeah,
there looking
at your. Yeah, we're not doing it, and we have tried. Like.
And I've talked
really
about that.
Fucking hard.
And so, what have been the suggestions that I've made so far?
To use netting that we don't think works. To try to ground our system out better, I think the thing that we need to do, which we discussed yesterday, is have piglets at a different time of the year. I think that's what we need to do.
In the blazing hot summer, when it's dry, the fence just doesn't work. I don't care what you do, it's not gonna work.
We could get a better charger.
There you go.
That might work, but we'll see. It might help, and it very well might not, because if you don't have the ground, it doesn't matter how strong your shock is. It just doesn't. If the electricity cannot make the loop.
Yes, the electricity needs to make the loop, and it is a common problem that when things get dry enough that the electric fence becomes less effective.
And when I talked to people in, I went to a Joel Salatin workshop last August and talked to people about this, and they were like, put grounding rods everywhere. You need to have 6-foot grounding rods everywhere. Well, we did that, and it doesn't work. So I, you know, I'm a little bit like, okay.
All right. So my first advice when you guys told me about this, as I said, you need to get a hotter pop. In fact, the other thing is that, and I think I've mentioned this in podcasts before, that it's like, don't bother with the things that run on a battery or have a little solar panel on them. They're not hot enough. What you need to do is you need to get the stuff that plugs into your house. And it draws like almost no power, like 5 watts per month. So almost nothing. But the thing is that you're trying to, and then the other thing is that I suggested is that, and I didn't even say you have to get the electronet fence, but you were asking, how do you make this work in this scenario? And I said, in that scenario, you use the electronet. That's what people use. But really the thing is that I think you need to, stop buying that stuff that you're buying. The plain wire, I'd say stop buying that. The stuff that's green, stop buying that. The thing to do is to get that stuff that's black and white. Because what you want to do is to build a psychological barrier. You want something so when the animal sees it, the animal goes, I know what that shit is, and I'm not getting within 10 feet of it.
What I found is that pigs continue to test fences, and this time of year, when there's apples over there and not apples inside the fence,
yes,
they will test that fence. They will find out it doesn't shock. And they
which
will
is exactly
right
where I'm going,
apples.
Which is now I'm going to hold my little recording thing over here. And so here's the thing, because right now what you have is like it's a low enough pop that when a pig gets a pop, a pig, and plus, especially with the dry that's going on right now, that when a pig gets a pop, then it's like a very tiny pop, and the pig says, how do I get past this? How do I get around this? How do I make it so that I'm not, I mean, I can do this. I can figure a path to get past this. And so that's what the pig is thinking. But if you've got a really hot pop, then, maybe the pig gets it during the wet season, But when you got a really hot pop, then the pig hits it once and realizes, I don't want to come anywhere near that shit ever again.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, whereas the mental thought is, I'm going to figure out how to get past this. This is bad, but I can get past this somehow. I need to think of how I'm going to get past this. So really, the big thing to do is to have such a hot pop that, we're going to end up making it so that the psychological barrier works. So it's a two-part thing. One is that you've got to have the visual, which is, I believe, that black and white, that stark black and white strand. Because that doesn't occur anywhere in nature. Right now you've got that green stuff. It looks like a green vine or something like that.
We don't use
and
that.
I saw it. And you've got
as an attempt, and I was like, that's not going to work. And, it pigs go right under that netting.
Okay.
And you know what?
Netting,
I have talked to other people about that netting,
that
too.
Netting. Hold on. When we first got that netting, when we first got our first two pigs, and it was wet out there, it held them till it dried out.
Right. And there's apples all over the ground.
And then Johnny was like, yeah, whatever, I'm going under that. And as he would get popped going under it, it just makes him run faster.
Right, right.
You're talking about a two-part system. I don't know if this is the same part, but the initial training pen, when the pigs are very small.
Their very first encounter.
This is what I've been learning. I've been doing this now for a couple, trying to shock pigs for a couple of years, and it has to be a small training pin that knocks the shit out of them right off the bat every time.
I'm going to disagree with that one, but go ahead and finish.
And then once you have them in there, in that small training pin, and they get shocked a couple of times, that knocks them down, then you can expand to the bigger thing, and they'll, like you said, they'll see that fence out there and go, yeah, I'm not going over by that. I know what happened. But it's that initial, their very first encounter with it has to be a really bad deal for them. If it's only mildly bad, yes, they will test it again and again to see if it's actually that bad and if it's worth it to go eat those apples over there.
Another point I'd like to make about the netting, I've asked other people about it. They were recommending it to me, and I was like, okay, so your pigs never get out of it? And they're like, oh, no, sometimes. If a fence doesn't work 100% of the time, in my opinion, it's worthless. It's a waste of time to go chasing animals around and trying to get them back into a pen. And so that right there, they kind of proved my point for me, is that if you can't absolutely guarantee that the animal is going to stay in that area.
All right, so
it's a waste. You're creating work for yourself.
It's all about pig training. Reading the Joel Salatin article about his pigs,
mm-hmm.
and they put up their fences, and they have to have a portable gate where the pigs go to the next paddock, because the pig, even after they take the temporary down,
mm-hmm.
the pig won't go across there where it was. Those pigs have been trained
right.
when they were little
right.
by a fence that knocked the crap out of them,
yeah.
and now they have to have a gate if they say, okay, here's where you can
go through,
even though that's not even there anymore. It's such a psychological barrier.
Yes.
They can't see it because it ain't there.
Right.
They still don't go there.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about why I recommended the electronet fence, and then I want to talk about how you should never put pigs into a small electric area. And so then the electronet was because you're saying, okay, your ground's dried up, and so you wanted to do a Posnig scenario. And so you were thinking about running strands, and some would be hot and some would be ground. And then that way, when they tried to go through the fence, they would end up touching both,
mm-hmm.
and then they would then get the pop again. And the problem with that is that those could end up touching when things sag just right and stuff like that, and then shorts it all out and doesn't work. That's why the electronet stuff is the way it is. You can get the electronet to be the Posnig, but it holds the wires a certain distance apart, so that way they don't ever touch. That makes it effective. So that's why I was saying, you know, if you're going to do Posnig, you kind of got to go with that net stuff,
that's
or you're going to effectively make a, or you're going to have to make your own electronet, you know, using standard wire or whatever it is that you're using. so that's just, that would in itself would be just a big job, and then you know, suddenly the electronet looks better. But all right, so setting that aside. You're creating a psychological barrier, and any time you have a small area, I mean, what you want to do is you want to have such a hot pop that the pigs don't want to come within 10 or 20 feet of it. But then if you're in a small little pen, and it's like they can't, like the most they
just
can get away, and
it, so
okay,
many.
Right.
To make sure.
No, no, I really
that's
disagree.
That's what Joel said.
Well,
that's
I, and you know what?
I
disagree with Joel a lot. He's a brilliant man, and I disagree with him a lot.
Yeah.
So I think that putting an animal into a small electrified area is like animal torture. I'm not okay with it. I'm very against it.
Even for a couple
of hours, that's I believe that's totally fucked up. This is you know, I mean, think of the psychological damage. How do you feel about the idea of being in one of those little chambers where it's got spikes on the walls and you can't and all you can do is stand in one place? And if you move an inch, you get stabbed. I mean, are you okay with that? And then you're only going to be in there for 2 hours. Quit your fucking whining. Of course, you don't get to sit down or lie down or anything like that because they're just every fucking where.
It's not that small,
but you get the idea of the picture that I'm painting here. You're creating a psychological barrier, and you're teaching your pig, oh, by the way, if you stay 5 feet away, you don't die, but of course, you're the thing that you should be teaching them is that when you see this black and white line, you want to be 100 feet away. But guess what? We've set it up so you can't be 100 feet away.
Whoa.
And so.
But then you're going to get really uneven grazing if your pigs aren't going to want to go anywhere near the fence.
Well,
I don't want 100 foot.
I don't want 100 foot
grazed
strip.
That's
exactly.
All around the edge.
Yeah, so that's why we've got the stuff that's going to be the portable fence. And so the next time when you move the paddock, then that's just an area that you include in it is you move the fence to the other side of that. So, I mean, there's ways to mitigate this stuff, but the thing is A, have a very hot pop. B, use that black and white stuff so it's got this visual marker. That's a huge component of the psychological barrier, this thing that doesn't occur anywhere in nature and has a very distinct look. And C, never put them in a space that's electric. I mean, I think putting them in a small space that's like all wood or stone or something, that's fine. They'll lean on the fence and everything's okay. They can be comfortable for short periods of time. I far prefer an animal to have a lot of room. But anyway, I think that when it comes to electric, there's ways, but you got to give them a big, because it's a psychological barrier, they got to get away from it. And that's another thing too. I think when you put them into a small space and it's like, you know, it's electric, it's like, this space that I'm in right now is unacceptable. I have to get out of it. And so now, in order for me to save my own life, I have to come up with a way to get past this extremely painful thing. If you're in a little box with knives and the knives are just inches away from you, aren't you kind of thinking to yourself, is there a way that I can hit the latch and get the door to open and get out of here? How do I get out of here? So it's a similar kind of thing. But I think just putting them into the torture box is not a good thing. So I train them in the field. And so when the first time you put them into a field, use extra strands of that black and white stuff. So that way it's like they're not trying to get under the wire. Because then once they've learned that thing is hot, and they will still test it, but then they're testing it once a month instead of testing it like 10 times a day. So right now it's like the apples are on the other side. How can I get past this to get the apples? But when you got a really hot pop, it's like, okay, the apples are on the other side. Damn, that's too bad because I'm not going anywhere near that fence. So that's the thing to shoot for.
What we've been trying to do. There's like the goal, and then there's what happens. And sometimes they're not.
The learning curve
is
steep. And
there is no handbook.
You can do all the internet research.
But you got permies. You could ask me.
You can do all the research. I've been to dozens of electric fence websites. But you still have to go. You have to do it for yourself.
Yeah, reading about it is nothing.
It's
nothing. Talking about it to someone is nothing.
Work. Yeah.
What about me? What about talking about it to me?
Talking about it to you just pisses me off. You tell me how fucked up I am.
Piss
me and I tend to get defensive. Even though it's not for
me. I
could really care less what the fuck you think.
You're so, Marina, you guys are awesome. Let there be no doubt about it.
So it's true. I pick
but
people up.
It is really difficult to try really hard and to try all these different things.
And then
someone comes along, walks onto your property, and is like, oh, I know how to fix all your problems. It's like, the fuck you do, actually?
Oh, yeah? Do I not?
Live here.
I don't live here. Have I been of any help?
You have some ideas.
You have some
and
ideas.
And if you came here and tested them, some of them might work. And I guarantee you some of them won't work.
Yeah.
But now I visit a lot of farms, and I see a lot of electric fence stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I see electric fence stuff that works, and I see electric fence stuff that doesn't work.
You know what I think it has a lot to do with?
What?
Is soil type.
I think soil type does. It's true.
It rains in the summer. There are heavy clay soils that absorb water. Mm. Here, it hasn't rained since May, and we have volcanic ash is actually our soil. And it
we can let
has
the hose
no
run.
Clay
we
at all.
We have an inch and a half hose.
Mm-hmm.
Water comes out of it about 20 gallons a minute.
Yeah.
You can let that run in the yard out there. And it'll make a wet spot, might make a 5-foot circle. And you could let it run for a month, and it
and
would make a 5-foot circle.
And 2 feet away, and it would be bone dry. That's our soil.
That's how dry.
And so for Joel Salatin to tell me, oh, you just need to do this and this and this, it's like, you have no idea what my conditions are, actually.
Yeah, the Shenandoah Valley.
It's not Virginia.
Where he is, the Shenandoah Valley, where he is, I mean, they have amazing 6-foot deep topsoil. And so,
and it
yeah.
rains regularly.
And it
yeah,
rains in the summer.
He's definitely got advantages. So on the farm I had, we had gravel. And so, we had a lot of trouble with the pop. We came up with, techniques to improve upon it. So we were experiencing a lot of the same problems. And then so basically we came up with ways to improve it. And then at the same time now in Montana, some of the soils, we've got patches of clay soils, patches of different things, but most of it is very gravelly. And so, similar kinds of problems to what you're talking about, but these things can be fixed and there's ways to mitigate the issues. And the Posnaig fence is one of those ways, because then when they bump into it, they're hitting the hot and the ground and then, pow, and then plus a very hot pop. Then the fence gets tested rarely.
Issues. Also, we've decided that we need to farrow at a different times of year. We're farrowing in the middle of the summer and the middle of winter right now, and we need to be farrowing in the spring and the fall so that the pasture is wet.
Pigs go out in the first time in the spring, rain 70 inches.
Their first encounter with the fence is memorable, unforgettable.
So you're feeling the pain from how I normally bring pain to all kinds of farmers, which is yes, I'm showing up and I'm acting like I know what the fuck I'm talking about, and it's totally fair to say I have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about. Totally cool with that. At the same time, I like to think that I'm making a big difference on a lot of farms. And so it's like, you take it and leave it, whatever you want to do. Now, of course, I love coming here to visit because you guys have got so much going on that is the kind of stuff that I like to see. And, like, even just right here in the kitchen, I'm seeing lots of cast iron. All your dishes are glass, pure glass as opposed to, like, all the different plastics and things I see in so many other farms. So there's so much good stuff going on. So I think you guys are on. But, yeah, there's always going to be struggles. But, of course, I think a big part of what we're trying to do at Permies is to come up with ways to make it easier. Because there's a lot of it is going to be a lot of people do have these experiences. And so, like, how do you get this electric fence stuff to work when your soil is so dry? And there are indeed strategies. So you're not the first person to travel this path. And you're right. There's a lot of people out there that are like, it just works. And it's because their soil, you're spot on. Their soil is awesome. So we don't want to hear them. We want to talk about, how do you get electric fence to work on dry gravel? Which is the question. And it's like this question's been asked, thousands of times per year for many, many years. So, a big part of permies.com is to save you guys this pain. If I show up in person and I start telling you this stuff, then yes.
We're going to adopt some things you've told us. The plug-in charger, for starters. And we do have the black and white temporary, we have that.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of, the things we've tried, it hasn't worked, and we're going to try some more stuff. And we've got a couple ideas from you now that we are going to try.
I think, unfortunately, like, as great as permaculture is, unfortunately, it can give people the idea that it's a system to make food production quick and easy, and it's not. And I don't think it's ever actually going to be quick and easy.
I think it's giving a gift to your future self. I think you can make it, if you do it right, you can get it to the point where all you do is harvest, and you don't have to water it, you don't have to fertilize, you don't have to do anything else.
Between now and 30 years from now, when that might be looking like that, I need to eat.
True. Now, so you've got your existing system.
Yeah.
And then we're talking about now go throw in some 6-foot-tall hugelkultur beds and maybe, when you get a moment, shape a chunk of land over here or a chunk of land over there. A lot of these are kind of also like winter projects, And so it's like, okay, we've got this excess of trees up there. And some of them have died from rot, and we can't use the wood for anything but maybe burning it. Let's throw some of that into a couple of hugelkultur beds. And then each year it should get to be easier. And so you're still,
It already is easier each year.
Yeah.
Compared
yeah.
to the first year when we were here, when the water, all it did was run on the ground out there, and you had to carry buckets into the house. Now it's easier. The water runs in the house right there and right out the other side. So things have got easier each year. The improvements improve, and it does get easier, but we're still a long way from.
And we're still our own general contractors. It's like, I feel like we're full-time farmers, and then we get to moonlight and work on our house sometimes. It's like, that's frustrating, too.
But then when you work in the easier thing, then hopefully that, you're investing in your own future.
Yeah.
But I like to think that with Permies, hopefully, with the forums at Permies dominantly, that the ideas that you get from that, as well as some of the general knowledge stuff, that hopefully, cut your labor perhaps in half overall, and frustrations in half, and collectively, help everybody move a bit forward. And you guys have already provided a lot of information on Permies that have helped a lot of thousands of people to have easier lives. So.
You guys, with those videos, you're an inspiration. You have been that for me, and I bet you're that for thousands and thousands of people out there. When you say that you sometimes struggle, it's still awesome.
Right. We're not going to sell out and move to town or something just because the pigs won't stay behind the fence. That's not.
Yeah.
We're just going to eat those pigs and try a new batch with a new, you know, a new strategy.
Each year a little bit, trying new things.
Bit different.
Which I think farming is like constant innovation. And it's just, I think the thing I like about permaculture is that so many of the things that are documented under the umbrella of permaculture are great ideas that have been shown to work. I mean, there are some books that are shit, you know, like the chicken tractor book. I think that's stupid. But,
chicken torture.
That's what it should be.
Torture.
Yeah. But there's a lot of stuff that's good ideas. And I think, you know, by reading these and Thousand's work too. And there's a lot of things that are worth thinking about that are like a step up. Mm-hmm. And rather than going out and then having to do that innovation and optimize it over 10 years, you can read about it and then, you know, see like, okay, here was the idea 20 years ago, the same idea 20 years ago, and here's a list of optimizations to where we get to today and what these folks are trying today. And then it's like, wow, 10 times less work than 20 years ago and 10 times more benefit. It's kind of like, wow, you know, I like this. Let's start here rather than starting where we were thinking about starting, which would have been what they were doing 20 years ago. So I it's at the same time, so much is moving forward so fast that if you skip out on a year, you miss out on a lot of the work that a thousand other people have done. And so anyway, but yeah, once you get hip deep in it, then it's hard to go online and look at this stuff. But it's getting easier and easier and more comfortable and more comfortable and life is getting, you know, so I think we started this segment of this podcast with the idea of it's been hard. Is that,
yeah.
You know, and sometimes are going to be harder than others. But hey, you got to have it be hard at some time just so you know how good it is at the other times, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody ever said it was going to be easy. You know, I never, you know, or people that do say that don't know and have never tried it. They read the book and go, oh, that's easy.
I can do that. I've read an article about that.
Yeah.
That sounds so easy.
Right, right.
I love hearing that.
Yeah. I think that there are people who go out and then they work hard for 20 years, they accumulate millions of dollars, and then they go and buy an already made farm. Or what they could do is what kind of sort of happened in Dayton is that that gal dropped a big bale of money, and Sepp Holzer showed up, and she hired in a bunch of track hoes, and after two weeks, she had instant farm. Mm-hmm. And so now she has nearly a kilometer of hugelkultur beds completely planted. They don't require any irrigation. And so this year she'll be able to make money on farming, but I kind of get the impression that's not really her thing.
the bale of money. You know, and being able to hire that equipment and those experts and professionals, yeah, that does make it, you know, if writing a check is easy. I can do that.
If there was money in there, yeah.
If there was money, yeah, I would write big fat checks and, you know, get stuff to come out and look at my wood piles.
So now you guys do have several things going for you that you could cash in on instead, but there's challenges in that space also, and that is that there are a lot of people that like to come here and help. However, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and most of the people who want to come and help, and I think this is a very common farmer thing. It's like, okay, I got a woofer or an intern, and it turns out me showing them how to do it takes more time than if I did it myself.
It's less than no help.
Yeah, you go into the
negative help.
It's negative. At the same time, and that's the case most of the time with most interns and woofers.
Right. It hasn't been that way every time. We've had woofers and interns that were amazing, and I wish they were here right now.
exactly that. And
there's a whole pile of them I never want to see again.
Yes. And so I kind of wonder how can you harvest the good and pluck out the weeds, so to speak, in that space. And it seems like there might be solutions down that road. We recorded a podcast not too long ago where we talked about, and you guys know who Dave Bainline is. No. So, you know who the Bullock Brothers are. Mm-hmm. So basically they had the same thing, but then they had one intern show up 1 year, and it was Dave Bainline. And he turned out to be a good one, a really good, a hard worker. And so after a while, he became the intern coordinator or something like that, mm-hmm. and then later the education coordinator or director of education, director of interns, director of things. And so basically they just started turning all this over to Dave. And then, of course, at the Bullock Brothers, their interns sign up for 3 months, but they typically hang out for 2 years. And it's like, you know, imagine if you had a good intern and the intern stayed for more than a year, then by the end of that year, they really know your systems. They really know. Then if you get a new intern in, then the experienced intern can help guide the new intern and then give you feedback on whether you should let the new intern go or keep the new intern around. Anyway, I'm just sharing something we did in a podcast a while back.
How many years did it take the Bullock Brothers before this amazing intern showed up? Because in my experience, the good ones are few and far between, and usually they don't want to stick around. They want to go on to the next thing.
Right.
And I'm a little bit like, okay, like, yeah, it would be great if other people were living here and we could leave. But, like, finding those people is actually very tricky. And if you're lucky enough to get a good intern, we had a farmhand that was here for 2 summers, and, yeah, he was amazing. And he went and got a job for Halliburton. And
has a job now, so we
could make some money because
we're
unable to provide the economic stimulus for him, unfortunately.
Right.
And I would love for that to be different, but I am still building my house.
Yeah.
Right, and that's the other thing. It's, you know, our house is a 5-year project, and we're in the second year.
So I got the signal that we're running out of time, and so I think this topic is a full podcast worth, and I think we did that podcast not very long ago. So I'm going to set this topic aside. Ivan, what's next on your list? Where is the list?
Yeah, I mean, you guys choose what you want to talk about, but everything that is about the challenges and how it really is, and when you are practicing it instead of just being at home reading and dreaming about it every single day. I mean, the difference there is interesting to get out.
Yeah, I find that a lot of people, when I first moved out here, I was like, oh, we're going to have a self-sufficient farm. And now that I've been living here for a few years, I understand exactly a little bit better about what it would actually take to actually really provide for all of your own needs. And I think the whole concept of self-sufficiency is a dumb one, and we shouldn't use it anymore. I think it's a...
The example I like to use is
actually
salt. I'm not self-sufficient in salt. There's no salt mines around here. There's nowhere to get it around here. I know of one spot that's like 30 miles away that I think is some salty clay because I've seen where the deer and the bear come and lick it. But that still doesn't make me self-sufficient, and that's just one aspect, and you have to have that.
Nuts and bolts. I mean, you're not like forging your own nuts and bolts.
Right. Are you going to have a foundry also so you can make a shovel?
Grow your own fabric to weave your own...
Yeah.
Well, some people
grow
do that.
Grow your own textile to weave your own fabric to make your own underwear.
Well,
I mean, it's
a
like,
lot of people do that, but that is a lot of work.
And do they also provide for all their food? And.
Some do, but yeah, I think that's a lot of work.
You can either way lower your standards. Like, have you heard of Eustace Conway?
No.
I think he's somebody that could probably be self-sufficient, but he's content to live in one buckskin suit in a teepee and eat squirrels all year. And yeah, that is a way of being self-sufficient. Sure, I want my lifestyle to be different from that. And so what I envision and what I think is more sustainable is a community of people that feed each other, and support each other. And that way, all the responsibility isn't on me. And when I say community, I don't mean like commune on one piece of land. I'm talking about like the larger valley. Individual owners of land.
There's trade between.
Yeah, working together.
Yeah.
We all don't have to live on the same piece of property or in the same house.
Right.
I'm a big believer in that form of community as well.
So yeah, there's going to be some materials, but then it's like I think there's a lot to say for, because like I think when people buy land or when they plant a huge garden and they're going to try and, you know, knock back 80% of their food bill or more, then there's a lot of safety that comes with that. Because when you watch the news, of course, the news is very fear-based. It's like, okay, everybody needs to freak out about this and freak out about that. And it's kind of like, at the same time, there's a lot of people where it's kind of like, well, you know what? I've got, I grow so much food that if I totally shut off my outside, I've got enough salt to get by for a few years. I've got enough nuts and bolts saved up to get by a few years. I mean, I could go several years without a trip to town. And with the food that I'm growing here and the wood and the stoves and things like that, like I could get by. And so there's a lot of people that are kind of like, that's, you know, it's a level of safety. You've got insurance. Mm-hmm. If the power goes out for a year, I'm good.
You don't even notice.
Yeah, you wouldn't even notice. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know what? You go into town and there's the restaurant thing, and there's the people thing, and there's the you know, there is buying the nuts and bolts, and sometimes there's a gizmo, and sometimes there's I don't know, watching a play, and there's other things, and it's like, so it's a lovely community-esque thing. Whereas you still have the safety. So self-sufficiency, you're right. I mean, like, some people will totally do it. And I think it's good to know about those people and how they go about doing it. But I also believe that you're right. It does seem like a quality of life that I know. It sounds like a quality of life that doesn't have pie in it. And so it's kind of like, I'd rather come up with a strategy that has pie and has a really clean shower.
And comedy routines.
And there you go. Hot and cold running water is a really nice thing. And something that's predictable and easy to figure out. So, comfort, a certain level of comfort. And I'd like to think that we could come up with systems that are going to be, as comfortable as what a lot of people experience in town, and only with a lot more safety and a lot less expense. Now, of course, there's two different routes to doing it. One is to earn all the money and then you just pay for it in one big gob. But I think what a lot of us are is we're working at some kind of grind. We barely get out of debt. And we've got a little bit of money in the bank, not enough to buy a whole piece of land. And it's kind of like, but I just can't work this job anymore. I hate this job. And I want to get away from it, but to go where? And then so one of the choices is buy bare land, and then basically the whole mortgage-free thing, build a shack that's really crappy, and then you build a better shack that's going to be your longer-term shack. And then when you're in the longer-term shack, then you start building a home that's going, you know, and then you've dodged the whole mortgage thing, which has saved you like $400,000 over the lifespan of the property. So there's these strategies. And, of course, you know, going out and collecting up bits and bobs that help you to build all of this stuff. So, I mean, you're getting the thing that you want, but without having to go through all of that slavery to get there, through working way too long in the city doing something you really can't stand. All right, so it's hard. What else is on the list? I'm getting signals again that we're out of time, but let's see if what else is on there. I know Ivan was very excited to hear you guys get onto a podcast. He feels this is like people need to hear your guys' experiences. Do you want to bash me some more? I'm okay. I have a really thick skin. Go ahead.
No, I think that what
you're doing
is great.
I don't intend to piss you off. I'm trying to help.
I know,
and that's...
I can take it. Bring it. What have you got?
Well, like, someone was like...
You admit that.
Yeah.
That makes it totally different.
Definitely.
You're here being arrogant and...
I'm always arrogant.
Well...
But you qualify it
you
by
qualify
saying that, and that makes it okay.
And that's why I haven't sent you down the road already.
All right.
So, and...
I'll help you no matter how much it hurts you.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Oh, okay. All right.
And you are helping us.
Wrap this up then.
What else is on, Ivan, what's on this list that you need, you feel like the pod people need to hear?
Oh, well, I mean, the challenges and the yeah, like, how has it really been to have the pigs and what are the challenges? You mentioned the fencing as one, but also with a cow, which seems like a great idea if you can get out 17,000 calories out of that cow in a day. I mean, that sounds like a super deal, right? But then it ends up being all this work. And, yeah, just details like that, which we probably won't be able to go over properly because we are leaving on our tour. But
I think that's one thing that kind of shocked me is I remember when I was here a couple of years ago, you guys loved that cow. Like, this cow was
No, I know.
And that it defined a big part of what all you were doing, and it was like, man, this cow is the huge aspect of what we're doing. And now the cow is gone. The cow's been butchered. And now the message I'm kind of picking up is like, oh, life is so much easier without the cow because we don't have to go and milk her all the time and stuff like that. So now, and I think that this is something that I've heard a lot of. A lot of people go and they do the homesteading thing and they do it for a while and then they're like, you know what? Fuck it. Now, it's just too much work. Mm-hmm. And that's where I kind of, I'm hearing this from other people. I mean, there's aspects where it's like, okay, that was fun for a while and then it got old. And this is where I kind of think, like, well, when you're in, if you can do the 20 people under one roof thing or the 20 people on one property thing, then it's like, then I think it gets way easier.
Oh, yeah.
And especially when you've got, because when you have to work every day, 365 days a year, year after year after year, that does get old. And on the other hand, if you could just take a week off and go goof off, And that's the other thing too. We were talking about like having somebody watch your farm or having a friend watch your farm or paying somebody. And it's like, you don't know that they're doing it right.
You're not relaxed on your vacation because you're worried about what might be going on at home when you're not there taking care of it yourself.
I once went on a trip to go to a wedding and, on the way, I was a little nervous about the people who we'd had to bring in to milk the goats. And so our goats, you know, like, got milked only once a day at 5 o'clock every day. And so we were very emphatic. You got to be there at 5 to milk the goats. Yes, yes. Stop going on about it, will you? For crying out loud. This is like the 8th time you've said that. So called them up at 6 when they should be done. They hadn't gone out yet, you know. And so then called them at 7. They hadn't gone out yet. And it's like, and then at 8, called them, and they hadn't gone out yet, and it's like turning around, going back. I mean, are we going to get there and the animals are going to be dead? I mean, you know, have they moved the chickens? Do the chickens have water? You know, and it's like, so canceled the whole trip. Canceled the whole trip, went back. So, you can't really be truly comfortable. But if you have a bunch of people living on the land, it's like they know how to do it, and they've done it many times, and you know that they care, and that it's all going to be properly dealt with. So
finding the people that are in the same book, not even necessarily on the same page.
Right.
But you got to find at least people that are reading the same book as you are, and I think that's the really challenging part, is finding those people that are maybe even in that chapter of the book you're on.
For however much labor,
and
having
also
other people
that you can live with.
Right. For how much labor it could potentially save you to have other people around, like how much more emotional labor are you adding to your life by sharing your place with 20 people specifically is
right.
Quite a large number. I would love one other family to live here, and I think that would have our labor, which would be awesome.
In theory. But yeah, I think you're right.
I would just also like to say about the cow thing. We loved having the food from the cow, and we still really miss the cream and the milk and the butter. But we also realized that we have to prioritize our time right now, and if we want to get our house done sometime in the next 3 years, then we need to focus on that. And we were also, we got overly excited about animals and got them before we really had our infrastructure done. We, like, got animals, and then we were like, oh, fences?
Cows and pigs and no fences.
And no fences and no way to get water anywhere. I mean, and so we just had this realization, like, wow, we kind of, like, jumped the gun, and so maybe we should scale back until we're more prepared to deal with it. And it'll make it easier to do that much work with the proper infrastructure.
Yeah, infrastructure. If I have to give anybody advice on their raw piece of land, is get water coming out of faucets all over the place. You need to have faucets that you can turn on.
Because you don't like the bucket thing.
Yeah, carrying water is not fun.
Carrying water is not fun. And that's the
main thing. And it's amazing how much water you use in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and even if the price is having to carry it in a bucket and you're trying to be super thrifty with the water because you don't want to go get another bucket, it's like, did I really go through a whole bucket in an hour? Now I have to go get more.
Yeah,
that's a big one. All right, I am getting the signals again, and it's time to bolt. All right, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where I piss people off on a regular basis, and we talk about homesteading and permaculture all the time.